Ready to proceed now with our fourth argument of the morning, Shakir against Gonzalez.
Good morning, Your Honor. This case has two issues on appeal. The first one is whether the ruling was unreasoned and illogical and whether asylum should be granted or at least a new hearing on that point of the merits. And the second question is whether there's a due process violation that is so gross that must be addressed. Mr. Shakir's burden in this case was to prove that he had a reasonable possibility of persecution if he returned to Morocco. And I don't believe that a reasonable fact finder in this case could have found that he did not meet his burden.
Ms. Rosen, I just want to stop you for a minute because I want to clarify something, please. With respect to the due process claim, are you relying generally on the immigration judge having overstepped his bounds as a neutral arbiter, or are there specific ways in which you think his questioning prejudiced Mr. Shakir?
The first, he really overstepped his bounds beyond belief. He was not only failed to be an impartial arbiter, he was the prosecutor in this case. This was more like an inquisition. He asked more questions than the two lawyers combined by quite a bit in this case. And he was harassing, he was argumentative, and his questions were all irrelevant. But I'd like to address that second, if that's okay. Because I, on further reflection in my brief, I think that Mr. Shakir met his burden, and that independent of the due process violations, he's entitled to asylum because he had to just show a reasonable possibility, not probability, but a possibility of fear of future persecution. He first illustrated from the Quran and the Bukhari that apostates are subject to being killed. He then testified that his family and friends and everybody he knew were fundamentalists and that he was likely to be killed because they would do it. No one impeached him on any of this. The government didn't ask any questions about his family and friends, and neither did the immigration judge. The judge found that his conversion was sincere, but he ruled against Mr. Shakir on two grounds, neither of which were valid or reasoned, and they're not even logical. The first one was that he didn't believe Mr. Shakir was courageous enough to be a martyr for Christianity. And the second reason was that Morocco is not as bad of a place to live as Iran. Now, and even the BIA noted that that second line of reasoning was inappropriate. And as to the first one, this court said in Gilday most recently, we cannot uphold credibility assessments unmoored from the record based on nothing but the immigration judge's personal speculation
or conjecture. Is this a credibility question, counsel, or is it a question about whether there is substantial evidence in the record about the policy of Morocco's government toward converts?
Pardon me, I missed the beginning of your question.
You began by talking about what's required for credibility findings, but my question is whether this is a credibility issue or an issue about whether there is substantial evidence in the record to show that the government of Morocco does not persecute converts. Is this a question about your client, or is this a question about Morocco?
This is a question about my client because his claim was not exclusively based on the government of Morocco. He did provide evidence that the government looks the other way, but primarily...
We need to figure out what is persecution, and the fact that your client may be shunned by his former friends is not persecution.
I agree.
Right? If somebody converts from being a Roman Catholic to being a Mormon in the United States, he's going to be A, excommunicated, and B, shunned by a lot of people. But we would not say that he's been persecuted.
I agree.
Right? So this is all about what the government does.
No, because this is not in the United States, first of all, and we're not talking about being shunned. I don't care if he's shunned. I don't think he cares if he's shunned. He cares if he's killed. That is persecution. He cares if he goes to jail. The government does put Christians in jail, but the people will kill him, and it really doesn't seem to matter to me whether his brother kills him or the government puts him in jail. That's persecution. So I believe...
Is it then your position that the government of Morocco refuses to offer protection to people who are at risk of private harm? See, when we talk about private behavior as persecution, the usual way of doing that is to say that the government conveniently looks the other way.
Yes.
So is that the argument?
Yes.
But again, we come back to what is the policy of Morocco?
Well, I don't think that there was evidence that in this case that the policy of Morocco was to protect Mr. Shakir. The government.
I think that what I got from your argument, Ms. Rosen, was that that the government of Morocco apparently will let a Christian alone so long as he keeps his faith to himself. And as you noted, the immigration judge thought that there was no reason to believe that Mr. Shakir would be courageous enough to either proselytize or at the least practice his faith openly. His testimony seemed to support the notion that he will be open about his faith.
Yes.
And I take it that your argument is that that will expose him to differential treatment, such as surveillance.
And arrest, possible arrest and persecution. Yes, the record does not support the judge's finding at all that he will not be courageous enough. I don't know where that is, out of nowhere. He didn't ask any questions about that. He just said that. It is unmoored from the record because the record is to the contrary. So I think on that basis, my client did meet his burden. The due process argument
is there some reason why you are turning straight to the Constitution and not to the statute? And there's a federal statute requiring administrative law judges to give fair hearings.
Yes.
So why would we ever get to the Constitution unless your view is that statute is unconstitutional? It's a pretty fundamental principle of jurisprudence that one does not start with constitutional objections to the behavior of government. One starts with the statute.
Yes, my error. I will rely on the statute. He did not get a fair hearing, though, by any stretch of the imagination in this case. And the government's supplemental authority that they submitted this week does not say that you don't have that you do not have subject matter jurisdiction. And I just want to note on that point that the due process claim in that case from the Sixth District that they cited, Amaya Artaguaguada versus United States Attorney General. The court says in that sixth, as to the due process claim, that the BIA did not consider the due process argument, only the credibility one. And in this case, the BIA did look at the due process claim, and because it's so grotesque. The situation is shocking. The questions, I don't think there's any way to justify them, and frankly, I thought the government would concede error on this point. This is a judge whose behavior this is not the first time he's been inappropriate. For no more questions, I'll rest.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Tom Holtzman. I represent the Attorney General in this matter. The central issue in this case is whether Shakir, a convert to Christianity, has a well-founded fear of persecution if returned to Morocco, a predominantly Muslim but relatively tolerant country. The asylum officer, the immigration judge, and the Board of Immigration Appeals all rejected his asylum claim. The immigration judge and board found that he would face social ostracism if returned, but that such ostracism did not rise to the level of persecution. And nothing in the record compels reversal of that finding. The State Department's report makes clear that Christians may practice their faith openly and legally. The law prohibits interference with the practice of one's religion. Conversion is not a crime under the law. The government encourages tolerance and tacitly permits quietly done missionary activities, and there is a foreign Christian community whose institutions are present and active. And indeed, on the particular issue of whether Mr. Shakir will endanger himself, what he said at record page 129 was, "I will not provoke people." Essentially said, if someone asks me if I'm a Christian, I will say yes. But, I mean, he did not offer any indication that he was going, that his religion required him to go out and proselytize and provoke people. And there's simply no basis in the record for concluding that he will be in any particular danger at all, other than being shunned perhaps by family and former friends. With regard to the due process issue, we note the immigration judge is permitted by statute to interrogate the alien. In this case, he began the examination that Shakir complains of only after ascertaining that the party's counsel had finished their examinations. Much of his examination did seem relevant in attempting to link to see what Shakir's perception was of conditions in Morocco in light of the State Department's report.
You know, forgive me, in the briefs, in the brief you suggested that Judge Zerbe was only trying through his questions to round out the record in compensation for a very limited cross-examination of Mr. Shakir by the government. Then what I'm wondering is why did the judge rebuff the attempt of Mr. Shakir's counsel to ask some follow-up questions once the judge was through? I mean, in other words, if the judge is taking care to remain neutral, wouldn't you expect him to give both parties a chance to ask follow-up questions once the judge has finished asking all of his own questions?
Your Honor, I gave some thought to that point, and I reread the record at pages 158 through 60. And what you'll see, if you read that record carefully, is that what counsel wanted to do was to comment on the evidence. He didn't want to ask questions. He simply wanted to make comments on the evidence, and what Judge Zerbe said was, there will be a time for that when you have closing argument, and indeed, there was quite a lengthy closing argument with a lot of back and forth between the judge and counsel. But if you look carefully at those pages, and on appeal, there's been no showing of any kind of prejudice here. What would he have asked, and what answers would he have expected to elicit if he had been able to ask questions? There's simply no indication anywhere.
See, my concern, Mr. Holtzman, is with the appearance of partiality that arises when a judge takes over questioning. I mean, the judge's questioning here was more extensive relative to the number of questions posed by the parties themselves than even in the case of Gidey. And doesn't it raise a red flag when the immigration judge is asking two or three times as many questions as the petitioner or the government? And I must say, some of these questions about the law and about, Sharia law and...
I understand your concerns, Your Honor. This is a somewhat unusual case, but I think if you look at questions about Sharia law, may be quite relevant. I mean, after all, if Morocco is a Sharia law country, that makes it a country much more like Iran or Saudi Arabia, or a country where he would be likely to encounter many more problems. So the judge asked a lot of questions, and I think having reread the cross-examination, certainly some of those questions were justified because the cross-examination didn't do the kind of job of, you know, that one might have expected it to do of elucidating, you know, what was Mr. Shakir's perception of what was going on in Morocco and what he was likely to face? How realistic was that perception? What were the conditions like in Morocco? What did he know about those conditions? Did he know something that wasn't in the State Department's report? All of those are certainly relevant issues, none of which had been elucidated by any of the previous questioning. And so, yes, Mr. Zerbe asked, as immigration judge, a lot more questions than in many cases you might see, but if you look carefully at the kinds of questions he asked, they were quite relevant and quite on point. Your Honor, if you or I had been the immigration judge, we might have asked fewer questions and we might have asked them in a slightly different style from Judge Zerbe. But
such a badgering style. It's so uncivil and undignified.
I understand that, Your Honor.
We've seen so many of his cases.
I understand, Your Honor. But
same style used by senators questioning nominees for the Supreme Court.
So something like that. But at the end of the day.
Yes, but look at the prize. A little different. One gets the prize of being sent back, you know, to some third world country of some sort. And the other gets to sit on the Supreme Court for life.
Yeah.
Seems to me worth it.
I understand, but at the end of the day, the question is, after all of this questioning, what was the prejudice to his case? What points would he have made in response to this questioning? And
how can we know if someone is sitting there shaking in his boots, being attacked and badgered and talk to in
this might not be the right court to raise that point.
I understand that you've seen a lot of that. I'm sensitive to that fact, but you know, he was represented by counsel, and normally if something like this happens, counsel is jumping up and down and saying, Your Honor, if you're not going to let me question this man, I'd like to make an offer of proof as to what kinds of things I would elicit from him. And then the Board of Immigration Appeals and this court is able to, you know, try to figure out, was this man, you know, much as we may feel uncomfortable reading the transcript of the questioning, did this alleged violation of his rights make any difference? And we submit that it didn't in this case. This is not the particular issue of prejudice was not raised. It's been waived, and that should be the end.
I would disagree with you there. Even if the claim wasn't as clearly presented as it might have, might have been or ought have been, the board clearly understood the nature of the claim and rejected the claim on its merits. The board never said that the claim had been waived. So I think you're on tenuous ground.
Well, but the claim has two, if you permit me, Your Honor, the claim has two pieces. One is, did Judge Zerbe violate the person's rights? And the other piece is, if Judge Zerbe did violate the person's rights, was the person's case prejudiced? And this is not a case where, you know, he was unable to put on his claim, and he has not said how he was prejudiced. What was it that his counsel was unable to elicit from him that would have made a difference in this case? We don't know. I see my time is up. If the court has no further questions, we just ask that the petition be denied since the record doesn't compel reversal of the findings.
Thank you, Ms. Holtzman.
Thank you.
Ms. Rosen, anything further?
Just briefly, on the question of prejudice, you cannot tell what questions my client's trial counsel would have asked. And there's no requirement for an offer of proof, but it seems to me at this point that by his intensive and aggressive questioning, the judge allowed himself to make a finding that my client was not courageous and he would not be a martyr for Christianity. Not that he has to be a martyr for Christianity, but that was what Judge Zerbe found. And it was this extensive questioning when the judge was telling him, you're not answering my questions. And he found that my client didn't seem to know enough about French and Moroccan law. That it seems that at this time, that's where he could have come to his conclusion that my client had no courage. As to the provocation, when my opponent said that Mr. Shakir testified he wouldn't provoke anyone, that's quite true, but the fact that he's a Christian will be quite evident, certainly during Ramadan when he's not fasting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rosen. The case is taken under advisement.